Hey there, everybody. This is Dal Nagatone here. Yeah, so I am very much aware that this episode is super late, like a whole week late. And so I just want to take the time before the episode fully starts to like explain why. And the answer really comes down to, it was the election and Amanda and I were both, primarily me, because I was in charge of editing the episode. If you're going to blame someone for why this episode's so late, blame me. Were preoccupied with the election, you know, focusing on that. And we actually do discuss the election and how it was at the time we recorded it in that episode, which is now probably going to be super dated, so c'est la vie. But the point is that we figured that I figured that since I was so preoccupied with the election and most of America was preoccupied by the election. I figured that would probably be best if I release it later on when we were less overwhelmed by the whole thing, rather than just release it in the midst of the election, let it be like lost in the shuffle. So I just want to apologize on behalf of the show as a whole for this episode being late. And it's still a good episode, hopefully. So hopefully there's no problem with that. But yeah, the episode's out now, so listen to that. And the next episode, which episode 25, should come out on its regular schedule. So it should be out next Friday. So thank you very much for understanding, and we hope you enjoy the show. Everybody.
Hello.
Welcome back to Lost in the Vault, the podcast where we take an informal, irreverent look at the Disney films that don't quite have the magic. I'm your host, Dal Nagatone.
I'm the other one.
And yeah, welcome to season two, everybody. We made it.
We did.
Did you think when we got started that we'd make it this far?
I really didn't know. I was just kind of like along for the ride. Like, I kind of just still am, you know. I say, even though it's like, you know, I do put like time and hours into this and stuff like that, but I'm also just like, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Chill. We are this is currently going to be, if my count is correct, not counting all the bonus episodes that you did, this is going to be episode 24 total.
Wow.
Yeah.
Quite a few times.
Yeah. We're approaching episode 25, but we've been at this for, almost or over a full year now.
Yeah. It's been a year.
Pretty astounding. So that's something to be excited about. Now, with the introduction of season two, there are going to be some changes to the show. Yeah. As we probably mentioned in our introduction episode, I'm not sure, it's been a while. we had a game plan of what films we were going to discuss on the show and when. So for the first season, we limited ourselves to strictly theatrically released films under the Disney branding. But now, in season two, we are expanding that roster to include films from Disney's direct-to-video and television library. So already we barely made a dent in the films eligible for the show. And now we've got far, far more, like an excessive amount of films. So we could be going at this for like a decade and probably be nowhere near done.
No, there's so much content. They've put out so many things.
And tonight's film, which we'll be discussing, The Return of Jafar, is the first direct-to-video sequel, which when you think of like a Disney direct-to-video film, you're probably thinking of a sequel because that's primarily what they put out. Mm-hmm. So we figured to cap off season one and to begin season two, it would be most fitting to discuss the first Disney direct-to-video sequel from 1994. It's The Return of Jafar.
Woo. Yeah.
But before we get to the movie proper, we have to, you know, discuss the elephant in the room. Yeah, get it? Elephant?
Yeah.
So
We're recording this Wednesday night, November 4th. It's 9:16 p.m. And there's, knock on wood, still no decided winner for the 2020 presidential election.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. It's been a nail biter.
How have you been holding up? What have you been?
I have been knocking on every wooden surface that I can. I am agnostic, and yet last night I found myself praying to God, promising that I would be faithful to him and carry out his good works if Biden wins. Again, knock on wood. So, you know, I'll have to hold up that end of the bargain. Of course, I've got a loose conception of God's will, so, you know. It is interesting so far. I hesitate to say anything optimistic about it in the case of jinxing it. I think as a whole, we're all very much afraid to hope.
Yeah. I got home yesterday because I had to go back to my mom's house to vote because my mail-in ballot came in late. There were some technical things there, but, you know, I wanted to make sure I did it. So I did, pulled it together. I got back here. And me and my roommates finished half a bottle of rum and three bottles of wine.
Hey, my election night meal was Chinese food and McDonald's French fries and a McFlurry.
I had two dinners. I had Taco Bell, and then I had, when it gets cold, one of my roommates makes a soup. It's a family thing called Pot of Gold, and it's basically a deconstructed, like, grilled cheese and tomato soup. It's tomato soup with cheddar cheese and drop biscuits in there. So good.
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting seeing how this is going to shake out. You know, how late were you up last night?
I was up until 3 a.m. I was watching everything but my phone. I actually put my phone like on silent and watched an entire Netflix series and Hercules and the Hercules cartoon a little bit, you know, just literally just like whatever was coming to mind that would bring us joy, you know, because we were like, okay, we can have one night of this, you know.
I have been tuned to cable news nonstop. In fact, cable news is currently running in the background on mute as I'm recording this episode. Wow. So you'll have to forgive me if I seem a bit spacey this time. My mind's a bit preoccupied.
Yeah, totally fair. Took a big bath today and just like sat in the water and was like, yes, this is all I'm doing, you know? Because sometimes that's what you do. I've also been listening to like a lot of like Against Me and like the Dead Kennedys.
I've been binging on it.
All these really old, some of them not old, but like old like pop, not pop punk, just like straight up like political punk bands and shit. And I'm just like, I.
All night I was listening to Beach Boys.
No. I'm listening to Fuck 12 ACAB, and you've got the Beach Boys going. I think that
expresses the divide between us.
Yeah, it's a good dichotomy.
Yeah, I do think it's important to mention that if this election does go our way, knock on wood, that it's still important. And this is going out to all of you listening, all, what, 15 of you?
Yeah.
Hey, sorry, we love you. We just like making jokes about our small viewer base. Yeah. The joke's on us, but it's still important to remain politically engaged.
Yeah.
Especially since we probably won't get control of the Senate with this election, which is, you know, disappointing, but honestly not completely unpredictable.
Yeah, I think whatever happens, we have to keep energy in politics up, because we have a our new leader is a Democrat, I think that we still need to like fix a lot of things systematically. So, but that's my opinion. And so like, I'm just hoping that to like see, to keep like keeping the energy up and like how people are like reacting to like bad shit happening politically, you know, and like doing stuff about it, because yeah.
I think it's worth noting that we were actually more on the pessimistic side of this election, to the point where we actually had like a game plan where if Trump had won last night, we were going to do like a David Letterman countdown, top 10 gallows humor jokes about the 2020 election. Like,
yeah.
So hopefully we won't have to break that out. And again, knock on wood.
So that's what our world looks like right now. But you all know that. And I hope that you're finding distractions.
Yeah. Like, and who knows?
I hope that you're being like tuned in and aware and everything, but like, You don't have to be every second, you know.
You can't let this like destroy your mental health.
Mm-hmm. Do something you love today if you're listening to this.
Yeah.
Maybe
something you love is listening to us and recommending us to all of your friends.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, before we move on from the election, legal weed in New Jersey, how about that?
Yeah,
I assume you voted yes on that, Amanda.
Yeah.
you junkie.
Yeah, I know.
Can you be a junkie for pot?
I think so, but I don't know.
Oregon just legalized possession of pretty much all drugs.
Wow.
Marijuana, cocaine, heroin, meth, it's all good there, go nuts.
Have a good time. The world, we live in it, and that's it. I don't know, I think I have tired out my opinions on that, you know.
Yeah, knock on wood. Yeah. Just make, you know.
Yeah.
So let's get to Return of Jafar. Now, as I mentioned before, this is the first direct-to-video animated film from Disney. It's the first direct-to-video sequel to a Disney movie, of which Disney would make many, many, many.
Many.
But in a way, it is also one of the most important films in the history of Disney and in film in general, because for those who don't recall, before The Return of Jafar and a handful of other direct-to-video films released that year, like Land Before Time 2 and the Darkman sequels from Universal, the direct-to-video movie wasn't like very legitimate. It was like the realm of like B-movie action flicks, B-movie slasher films, like the realm of companies like Vestron Video and Troma, you know. Yeah. It didn't have like a prestige behind it. But then Return of Jafar comes out, sequel to a hit theatrical release, makes a ton of money. Like, supposedly they sold 15 million of those, grossed $300 million worldwide. In the U.S., it was one of the top 15 highest selling videos of all time.
Wow.
So, yeah. And the thing is that Disney was not going into this with the plan of doing direct-to-video sequels to their animated films. In fact, initially, Disney was quite resistant to the idea because this technically was not meant to be a sequel to Aladdin, per se.
Nope.
Rather, this was supposed to be a pilot film for Aladdin, the television series, which was, you know, a Disney afternoon show released in syndication and followed the footsteps of another recent animated series based off of a recent Disney film, The Little Mermaid, the series. But of course, while Little Mermaid, the series was a prequel, and that's could just say, oh, this is set before the movie.
Yeah.
Aladdin the series was set after the events of Aladdin the movie and thus needed a special opening to like explain the new status quo of the characters.
So basically, like a bunch of other like Disney cartoons did that same thing where like the first five episodes are technically like a movie and everything. This one, they were like, hey, why don't we like put it on, you know, direct to video or whatever. And Michael Eisner was like, no, it's going to make us look cheap. We're going to look cheap, you know, which is funny because then, you know.
I think we should mention like the two guys who are behind both this mm-hmm. and Aladdin, the series, that yeah. being Tad Stones and Alan Zaslav, both of whom worked a lot on a lot of the Disney Afternoon series. Mm-hmm. Tad Stones, you probably know for probably his greatest contribution to our culture as a whole. He was the creator of Darkwing Duck.
Yes. Yep. He wasn't new to, you know, Disney animated television shows, which is, I think, a good thing.
Yeah, like Chippendale Rescue Rangers, yeah. Gummy Bears. Hercules the Animated Series, yep. The Buzz Lightyear Star Command series, which...
Everyone forgets about that one. Everyone.
Well, that one primarily aired on the ABC Kids Saturday morning block.
Yeah.
When Saturday morning cartoons were sort of falling out of vogue. That yeah. one, I mainly watched that series. Another pilot movie, a direct-to-video pilot movie they did for that series, which I'm hoping that we'll get to discuss at some point in the future, because mm-hmm. I really liked that one as a kid, because yeah. I was... huge into Buzz Lightyear.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I remember Buzz Lightyear Star Command, and there was like some like arcade or roller rink or whatever, and you know how there's always like a like weird unlicensed things painted on like their walls or whatever, and Buzz Lightyear Star Command characters were there was like a bunch of them painted on the walls for some reason. And so I remember every time going to like eating pizza in the corner, just looking up and seeing like that big orange alien dude from that show and being like,
Booster? You talking about so Booster?
Yeah, I think that's his name. I mean, I haven't seen it since I was a kid, but.
So supposedly, according to Tad Stones, it was actually him who came up with the idea of, instead of this just being like an hour long television special, to instead turn it into a direct to video movie. And he took the idea to like yeah. the Disney higher ups, and it took them a bit of convincing. But eventually it happened. Yeah. And as we mentioned before, like it became a huge hit and led to more direct to video sequels. But the thing yeah. that
they should be glad that they made that decision.
Here's the thing. The direct-to-video sequels, it's sort of Michael Eisner's fears came true. It did kind of cheapen the Disney brand, thus making traditionally right. animated Disney films a lesser commodity, and was one of the key factors that led to both the death of traditional animation in theaters and the ousting of Michael Eisner as CEO. So, this Tad movie. Stones, yeah. unwitting instigator of doom?
Wow.
You think sorry, Tad Stones, if you're listening. Love and respect to you. Darkwing Duck makes up for any unintentional harm you may have caused.
Or did you plan it all along? No, I probably had.
No.
I'm kidding. You know, you can't predict those things are going to happen. But yeah, no, it's insane. Like how it can domino effect like that, you know?
Actually, funny, Tad Stones actually did leave Disney in 2004 and has mainly just been like kicking around the animation industry. He actually worked on a direct-to-video Hellboy movie with Mike Mignola.
Oh, nice.
He did a direct-to-video Brer Rabbit film for Universal. According to an interview I read, he actually came up with an idea for a direct-to-video Scooby-Doo film around Ooh. 2003, Scooby-Doo and the Anime Invasion. Which got canned because apparently the idea didn't test well with moms. I guess, they're still afraid of that anime.
Yeah, and now it's everywhere. It's permeated our boundaries.
Well, I don't think anime is omnipresent as it was in the 2000s.
Not to some.
Like, I remember the 2000s anime with, like, all the rage. You know, you had Toonami on Cartoon Network.
Yeah. Well, now what I mean is it just kind of, like, lives on as, like, yeah, anime is a thing. And it's like, just, you know, it's not weird anymore. It's just kind of there.
So there actually was, like, for what was meant to be, because let's be fair here, the animation is definitely lacking in comparison to the original film.
Yeah.
But, you know, you got to remember that this was originally devised for television. They were working on television budget. And like a lot of the Disney Afternoon stuff, it looks really good for like a Saturday morning cartoon, because that was like one of the key ideas of the Disney Afternoon. Like they're going to put more effort into the actual animation, you know, original characters, not going to be like cheap marketing tie-ins. And it ended up paying off with, like, you know, DuckTales and Gummy Bears and all and all that. Honestly, the Disney Afternoon's probably one of the most important contributions to television animation. That and Nicktoons.
Yeah, I think, I mean, they were both doing different things. Nicktoons, I think, was more, like, explorative for at least a while, you know.
Anarchic, like, I'd say.
Yeah, that's the word. Chaotic and whatever.
Both on screen and behind the scenes with I think of those three original Nicktoons, the only one that had a pretty stable production was Doug, and Doug was the worst one.
Doug sucked.
That reminds me, we're gonna have to do Doug's first movie on this show at some point.
No. It's okay. I can get through it.
But yeah, they did get back like a lot of the original cast of the film. You know, Scott Weiner as Aladdin, along with Brad Kane's singing voice, Linda Larkin as Jasmine, Jonathan Freeman as Jafar, Gilbert Gottfried as Iago.
Yeah.
The only exceptions for who they could not get back are, first, the singing voice of Princess Jasmine, Leah Salonga. Instead, her singing voice in this movie is Liz Calloway.
It was Anastasia.
She what? Really?
I believe so.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah, she was the singing voice of Anastasia. She's the singing voice of Anastasia and Odette from The Swan Princess, and Kiara in Lion King 2. So.
And she also was the original Ellen in the original Broadway production of Miss Saigon.
Yeah. So she sings.
Yeah. Second is Douglas Seal as a Sultan. Here he's played by Val Bedden. Val Bedden was a voice in a lot of Disney stuff. He was Dawson in The Great Mouse Detective.
Oh, yeah.
Egon Pax on Gargoyles.
Which character?
Egon Pax is the name I'm seeing.
Oh, is that the butler of... hang on, I think that's the butler.
I'm not familiar with Gargoyles. You'd have more authority on that than me.
I've been thinking about I watched Gargoyles last year, not the entire thing, but up until like the last season, where I just kind of fell out of it because
it sucks.
Yeah, it was getting a little weird. I mean, like, it was already really weird, but I was like, okay, yeah. But Egon is who the fuck is Egon? I don't know.
And then here's the big one. Robin Williams as the genie.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the history, as we alluded to in the Popeye episode, the history between Robin Williams and the Disney company is very contentious. Initially, it was actually smooth sailing. And it begins in the late 80s with the film Good Morning Vietnam, which at the time Good Morning Vietnam was in production, Robin Williams' film career was in a slump, just like dud comedy after dud comedy.
Yeah.
Like, I watched one of his like 80s comedies with my grandfather. The Best of Times, I believe it was called, with Robin Williams and Kurt Russell. He was hyping it up as like the funniest movie ever made. And it's about like these high school guys who are like football players on the team, and they like, and they're like all like out of school and, you know, living their adult lives, and they end up playing another football game against their old high school rivals. And and like Robin Williams plays like a guy who's hated by his hometown because in the big game in his high school senior year, he misses a catch and ends the game in a 0-0 tie. So, you know, everybody always tells him, "Oh, you dropped the ball." And my grandfather was laughing at it like it was the funniest thing ever. And I was just like, what the fuck are you talking about?
So I love it when old people have like, love like one thing that's not good, but they're like, it's the best thing, you know?
And yet whenever I show him any of the comedies I like, he's always like, where's the humor?
But he dropped the ball.
One of the comedic set pieces in that film, and I'm not dissing my grandfather, our comedic sensibilities actually overlap quite a bit. But there's one comedic set piece in The Best of Times where it's literally just them, Kurt Russell and Robin Williams having dinner with their estranged wives, and yet also trying to sneak watching a football game at the same time. Like, height of hilarity right there.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, it's it's not very good.
That's okay.
But, you know, what do you expect from the guy who directed Stop or My Mom Will Shoot?
Ah, yeah.
Also, Tomorrow Never Dies, he did.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, and Turner and Hooch. Hmm. We're getting off topic. Back to Return of Jafar. So, you know, Robin Williams is Disney sees potential in Robin Williams, and they end up finding the project Good Morning Vietnam for him, which Paramount put into turnaround and Disney snatched up the rights to. And it becomes a huge hit. And then that followed up with Dead Poets Society, another Disney production, pretty much reestablishes Robin Williams's cred in Hollywood. And so Robin Williams is pretty grateful to both. Robin Williams is pretty grateful to the Disney company. So in the early 90s, at the time Robin Williams is doing a Hook for Steven Spielberg, Disney comes to him and is like, hey, we're doing this animated film of Aladdin, and we want you to be the voice of the genie. And, you know, they show him the test reel that Eric Goldberg did of like the genie animated to recordings from Robin Williams stand up, and Robin Williams really likes it, and Katzenberg comes up to him and is like, come on, it'll be something your kids can watch.
Yeah.
And of course, Disney doesn't want to pay like Robin Williams high fees. They wanted to work for scale on this one.
Yeah.
So Robin Williams agrees to do it, and he agrees to work for scale. Because at the time, Little Mermaid success was considered an outlier, like Beauty and the Beast hadn't come out yet.
Mm-hmm.
But he has a few conditions, because around the same time that Aladdin was planned to come out, you know, the fall of 1992, another Robin Williams film was due to come out, Toys, which was a pet project for Barry Levinson, the director of Good Morning Vietnam. Yeah. And Robin Williams also felt he owed something to Barry Levinson for Good Morning Vietnam, and he agreed to be in it to, you know, because he wanted to help out Barry Levinson, and because this was Barry Levinson's passion project for like 15 years.
Yeah.
And so he didn't want the release of Aladdin to overshadow the release of Toys.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a few conditions. One, his voice could not be used in any merchandise.
Yeah.
Two, His name, Robin Williams' name, could not be used in any marketing materials for the movie. Like, they couldn't say, this has the voice of Robin Williams as the genie.
Yeah.
And three, the genie could be in no more than 25% total of any of the marketing materials. So he could only take up 25% of the space in the poster, 25% of the space in the advertising, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Now, at first, Disney followed the rule to the letter while also bridging it. Yeah. Like, I'm going to bring up the poster for Aladdin right now, just so you can see. Let me just put that on screen share.
Cool.
So you can see right there, right?
Yeah.
In that poster. Now, technically, because most of it is smoke cloud, yeah, the genie's head and hand only take up 25% of that poster.
Yeah.
But he's still the biggest thing there. So it's sort of violating the spirit of the agreement.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then supposedly, there were bus station ads for Aladdin that featured just the genie on it.
Yeah.
Because Disney felt they were in the bind because of Robin Williams' improvisations. The character that get the most positive response out of test audiences was the genie.
Yeah.
So they felt they had to abide by that and like give the people what they want.
Yeah.
And Katzenberg being Katzenberg, when Robin was complained about these bus ad station ads with just the genie, he had agreed. He said that he would take them down, but only took them down in areas that Robin Williams was likely to see.
Wow. Wow.
And then eventually when Robin Williams ended up winning a special achievement Golden Globe certificate.
Yeah.
For his role as the genie. Disney, violating the contract entirely, tries to do like a 4-year consideration campaign for Robin Williams as the genie, which at that point, that was the last straw for Robin. And he, because he was already getting digged on in Hollywood for doing that movie for scale. Like there was a joke that was going around. Why won't Disney sign a check for Robin Williams? You try holding a pen with four fingers.
Yeah.
So Robin Williams vowed that he would never work with the Walt Disney Company again. And Disney and Katzenberg tried to bury the hatchet by giving him a Picasso worth $5 million.
Wow.
Because, you know, Katzenberg.
Yeah.
And then it turned out that the Picasso they gave him, they bought it at a estate sale for $750,000 because, again, Katzenberg.
Wow.
Now, eventually, Robin Williams does patch things up with the Disney company, but we're going to leave the explanation for how that happened for when we discuss the third Aladdin movie, Aladdin the King of Thieves.
Yeah.
You know, consider that a tantalizing little cliffhanger.
Yeah.
But needless to say, in Robin Williams' place, they end up casting Dan Castellaneta as the genie, who would also play the role in the animated series.
Yeah.
Now, let's be clear here. I love Dan Castellaneta.
Yeah.
He is a very talented voice actor.
Yeah.
Homer Simpson is one of the greatest all-time cartoon characters.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of that comes down to Dan Castellaneta's voice performance,
yes,
which finds like the perfect balance between genuine sincerity and also like a doofy simpleton.
There's like aloofness, like, but also like it's
like everything that comes out of Homer Simpson's mouth in that voice is hilarious. Like he is the platonic American man.
Yes.
Homer Simpson.
Yes.
And it, again, it comes down, a lot of it comes down to Dan Castellaneta's voice.
Yeah.
But let's be for real here. Dan Castellaneta is no Robin Williams.
It's just a surprise to me that he was the choice because of the, like, and I know he's Dan Castellaneta has done other things or whatever. But like, what character is he on The Simpsons? He's Homer. He's Krusty
the Clown, Grandpa Barney, Sideshow Mel, Groundskeeper Willie, Mayor Quimby, Hans Moleman. He's Hans Moleman.
The thing about most of these characters is that like even at their most like energetic, they're all pretty like low lying, like, you know, pretty like
they're more sedate.
Yeah, that's the tone in the voice acting and everything. You know, they have very like fun, cartoony voices, but like they're not fast talkers. They're not like
they're more grounded.
Yeah, they're not doing these really high energy, like impulsive feeling, like Robin Williams is, I mean, it was all improv. Everyone kind of knows that, you know, with Genie. So like,
in fact, apparently there was so much improvisation in Aladdin that it was disqualified from being nominated for a Screenplay Academy Award.
Wow.
Yeah.
But like, that should tell you that you need like a very energetic voice, you know? Yes, Dan Castellaneta is very talented. It just wasn't the right fit, I don't think.
Who do you...
I don't know who would have been the right fit, to be completely honest with you.
I think Robin Williams is probably Robin Williams was probably irreplaceable. No, yeah. Definitely irreplaceable. Yeah. But...
Yeah, and then...
And again, I love Dan Castellaneta. Uh-huh. Like, genuine talent. Just, yeah. You know, and not the right fit for this.
It's completely unrelated, but it's not like even in the 2019 Aladdin, right, where you cast someone else as Genie, you know, and they decide on Will Smith, it's the same problem. These people are too aloof, you know, in a way, in comparison to...
Well, weren't they going for like a different type of character entirely with the live action Aladdin's Genie?
I guess so. I don't know. I still haven't seen it. But like,
neither have I. We'll eventually have to, yeah. Probably when, you know, it gets around to, yeah. Unless they end up doing that Prince Almond spinoff for Disney Plus, yeah. That they're like trying to do. And remember they're doing that apparently.
Yeah. Interesting.
You insert obvious twisted Team Star Kid Tiger Fucker joke, yeah. Here. Tiger Fucker, Tiger Fucker, okay. Tiger Fucker, Tiger Fucker. We remember Ahmed, the Tiger Fucking Man. Man, we're showing our age with that reference.
Yeah.
So here's a question I want to ask you.
Yes, ask away.
Because I don't think anyone's ever brought it up in relation to the recasting of Robin Williams as a Genie. Mm-hmm. If Robin Williams had not had that feud with the Disney company, would he have come back to voice the Genie for this film, do you think?
I don't see why not. Honestly, I think he might have.
Well, there's a cost reason, for one thing. Mm. You know, he probably would have asked for more money.
Yeah.
For this time around.
Well, probably, yeah.
Yeah, and let's not forget about the fact that... you know, Robin Williams is like still a pretty big name still around that time. Yeah. And what am I saying still? He was a pretty big name throughout the 90s. So it's definitely questionable whether or not he would return to do like a film and a direct-to-video film, which, again, reminder, at the time was still considered the realm of cheap B movies.
Right. If they had, upped the budget by a lot specifically for Robin Williams, which... Honestly, they might have done because how big he was, but
they did for Aladdin, the King of Thieves, where they paid Robin Williams $1 million to reprise his role as the Genie.
Wow.
But again, that was after the whole, you know, feud and reconciliation.
Yeah.
I personally think that he probably would have reprised his role for the movie Return of Jafar, but probably not for the animated series. Mm. You see a lot of parallels in that. Yeah. Like, for instance, we mentioned the Buzz Lightyear of Star Command pilot movie. In the pilot movie, Buzz was voiced by Tim Allen proper. But for the rest of the series, Buzz Lightyear would be voiced not, but by Patrick Warburton. Yeah. Because I guess Tim Allen was too busy doing For Better or For Worse and Joe Somebody.
Yeah, you said Tim Allen proper, and then I was like, Tim Allen improper. which I don't know what that means, but you know, yeah. So I probably wouldn't have stuck around for the entire animated series.
That's not to say that the new cast characters in, character singular, in Return of Jafar isn't a pretty solid get. Playing the secondary villain of the film, Abyss Maul, Jason Alexander, George Costanza from Seinfeld. So, you know, getting one of the main cast members of one of the biggest sitcoms in America to not only be a voice in your direct-to-video film, but also a recurring character in your anime series, that's a pretty solid
get. And it's really funny because you can tell so much that it's him, and it's like, oh my God, every time he opens his mouth.
Yeah, like Abyss Maul is very much supposed to be what if George Costanza was a Disney villain?
So he's kind of like pathetic. And it's
and this wouldn't be Jason Alexander's first rodeo of the Disney company. He was also the voice of one of the gargoyles in Hunchback of Notre Dame. Which one was he? Hugo, right?
No, he was he was Hugo.
Yeah, and then he was also the voice of one of the villains of 101 Dalmatians 2. Mm. Not 102 Dalmatians, that's the live-action Glenn Close one. Yes. 101 Dalmatians 2 is the direct-to-video anime
one. The one about Thunder and Lightning, the two dogs.
Thunderbolt. And Lil Lightning.
And
yeah, he plays Lil Lightning. Yeah. And then it also has Martin Short as, like, an eccentric painter.
Isn't it crazy that that movie was probably, like, my introduction to who George Costanza is, and that when I think of George Costanza, when I think of Jason Alexander, I think of the dog from the 101 Dalmatians sequel. Because
that's honestly, when I think of Jason Alexander, I think of him playing Boris Badenov in the 2000 Rocky and Bullwinkle movie, which, by the way, is the best work from Kenneth Lonergan.
Fair.
Fuck Manchester by the Sea. It's all about moose and squirrel.
Yes.
For me. But the primary focus of this film is Iago.
Yes.
Weirdly
the
enough.
Weird,
and that's
the weirdest choice for like a character to focus on. But you know what? I think it works.
Yeah. I think, well, it comes from the fact that Tad Stones developed a genuine fascination with the character.
Yeah.
And watching the first Aladdin, it was like, I want Iago in this series as like part of the main cast. And the problem was it ends with Iago trapped in a lamp with Jafar. So we need to figure out a way to get him out of there and get him back in with the main cast. So essentially the entire film is dedicated to explaining that.
Yeah.
Like they spend less time explaining why the genie comes back than how Iago joins the main group.
Yeah.
Iago gets, what, two songs in this movie? Yes. With Gilbert Gottfried singing.
Neither of them are great.
Yeah, none of the songs in this movie are great. No. In fact, I question why there are songs in this movie.
It feel like it should be a musical.
Well, the series wasn't a musical.
Yeah.
It was just an adventure series with like a villain of the week. And the series was actually pretty solid. Yeah. You know, a lot of memorable bad guys, some fun episodes.
Yeah.
Probably won't be as beloved as like DuckTales or Darkwing Duck or even New Adventures of Winnie the Pooh. But I think it's a solid B grade.
Yeah.
Disney afternoon series. Yeah. But
it's a lot of fun.
But for some reason, they decide they have songs in this. And the songs are either bad because they are poorly constructed. Like, for instance, the genie song, which is just wretched, easily the worst one of the bunch. Yeah.
The Moscow Circus hired me to fly Trapti.
On Mount Olympus ran a race with Hercules.
It's easy when you're chased by
Gillespie!
Sometimes when I sneeze.
Like, a lot of nonsensical, non-sequitur lines. I think part of the problem is that a lot of the lyrics of the songs are directly tied to the images on screen. Mm-hmm. Which I think is a big no-no when you're doing animated musicals. You want lyrics that are in synthesis with the visuals, without it, but you can still like listen to and understand, yeah, like on the soundtrack and on in the car.
They don't depend on, they shouldn't have to depend on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And granted, the song from Return of Jafar wouldn't get a soundtrack release until the soundtrack album for Aladdin and the King of Thieves. Mm. But still.
Yeah.
And then other, and then the, on the other hand, they're bad because they are primarily sung by Gilbert Gottfried.
Yes. yeah.
And I think Gilbert Gottfried would agree. He's joked that the songs he sings in Return of Jafar are played on radio stations known for playing quote unquote difficult music.
Yeah.
You know, that classic Gilbert Gottfried humor.
Yeah.
You ever hear the story about how, like, right after 9/11, Gilbert Gottfried joked at, like, I think an event at, like, the Friars Club or the Playboy Mansion or what have you. Hey, I'm sorry I'm late. My plane made an emergency stop at the Empire State Building, like, right after 9/11.
Wow. Oh, my God.
He got fired from his gig as the Aflac duck because he made a joke about the Japanese tsunami on Twitter. Oh my
God. How?
He's sort of like Don Rickles, where he can just get away with spouting offensive shit because, I don't know, some weird sorcery he has.
No, but I don't think many people take him seriously. I think that might be why.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, Don Rickles could just insult and mouth off against whoever for whatever reason. Everyone would love him anyway. He's probably the only person who could get away with making fun of Sinatra without being kicked the shit out of by the mob.
Yeah.
But again, we're getting off topic. So, yeah. So this is very much an Iago-centered movie. Iago's the one with the big character arc over the course of the movie.
Interesting choice. I actually do stand by it. I liked that choice.
It actually is really strong. I do like seeing Iago grow, and you actually do feel bad for him when he's all morally conflicted.
Yeah.
Because initially he's driven to jump with the good guys by Greave, but he actually starts to grow to like him. But then he's also driven by fear of Jafar.
Yeah.
And that's a weird shift with this movie, mm-hmm. that Jafar and Iago's relationship is more antagonistic in this one. When in the original, you know, they're very much on an even level. And I actually did rewatch the original before I watched Return of Jafar.
I did the opposite. I rewatched it right after, just because that's what happened. But like,
is it just me, or is the original Aladdin like very 90s?
Oh yeah, by far.
I don't mean just in like, in terms of its like racial or gender politics, though definitely there, or even with a lot of Robin Williams outdated references that also factors there, but also like the smaller stuff, like, you know, we can't glamorize Aladdin thievery, so he's got to immediately give up the bread to the little kids, even though, you know, he's literally stealing to survive. Jasmine's dissatisfaction of being stuck in the palace is totally comparable to Aladdin's frustration with living in abject poverty. They're totally on an equal level. Very 90s. I hesitate to sound like a dipshit Twitter leftist. Very neoliberal.
No, first off, when you said 90s, I just imagined Aladdin himself, but as just kind of like some asshole grunge kid, which I could have also seen, you know, like,
he's got the hair for it.
Yeah, like some asshole, like, hey, you want to come see my band play? We're playing in, we're going to be doing covers of Toto songs, but like using exclusively trash cans and using the sound of the microwave to as the to keep us going, you know. We're gonna order pizza and it'll be chill. You wanna come? But the other thing was that when we were watching the movie, one of my roommates was like, have you ever thought about how Aladdin's a class traitor? And I was like, yeah. And they were like, are you gonna mention that on your podcast? And I was like, I don't know. But here I am mentioning it on the podcast because he does, just like in the first movie, like, is like helping people, but then in the end is just like, okay, I'm royalty now. Peace, y'all, you know, like, sucks to be you.
Yeah, that definitely does carry into the sequel, where it opens with Aladdin after like stealing a stolen treasure back from Abyss Maw's gang. Distributes it on Agrabah's poor.
He just kind of, when you say distributes, you mean he throws it onto the ground as he flies by.
Yeah, which, let's be real here, probably destabilized Agrabah's economy for a bit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can't introduce that much money into circulation without decreasing the value of the dollar or whatever the currency is in
Agrabah.
Agrabah. You know, generic, nondescript Middle Eastern kingdom.
Yeah.
And then also, like, there's a sequence of him going out the village, dressed in, like, his royal clothes, being like, hey, Abu, let's see what the common folk are doing. So I guess Aladdin's now living out his dream of being Rodney Dangerfield in any Rodney Dangerfield movie.
Yes.
He goes up to the marketplace. Hey, naked lady teeth. Hey. Oh, this is the worst looking hat I ever saw.
Oh, my God.
You know what? I kind of do want to see Rodney Dangerfield as a Disney prince now. I know it's too late for that, but
that would have been great.
Honestly, you could argue that Aladdin is Rodney Dangerfield. I guess Jafar would be Ted Knight in this scenario.
Oh, my God.
The genie would probably be Bill Murray. Well, original genie would be Bill Murray. And then Dan Castellaneta genie would be Dan Aykroyd in Caddyshack 2.
Yes, definitely.
Like, you know, they're both good, but, you know, one is worse than the other. Who would...
Yeah.
I'm curious. I guess Jasmine would probably be Lacey Underall. Maybe, I don't know.
I guess so. I really don't know.
Though, you know, Jasmine doesn't take her top off in any of those movies.
Yeah.
And that all just leaves, who would Chevy Chase be?
It's a great question. The Sultan, I don't know.
Yeah, that tracks, actually, weirdly enough.
Okay, hell yeah.
Why are we talking about Caddyshack when we're supposed to be talking about Return of Jafar?
I don't know. I don't know how we got here. Yeah. What a dive back into. So
this story is supposed to explain how Iago gets out of the lamp and like joins the crew. Yeah. So it opens with, like, I guess Iago, because he's not a genie, he's not bound to the lamp, so he's able to pull out, which means, I guess, while Jafar is able to shrink his size, Iago is just like jammed in there, like in full size bird.
That. He's also been in there for a year.
Right. This is supposed to be set like a year after the first Aladdin, right?
Yeah. So he's been trapped in a lamp, probably eating whatever Jafar can conjure up, I guess. But like, he's been in there fully, you know, like same size. Just he's probably so, so broken.
Yeah. Like realistically, Iago should be twisted and malformed and barely able to crawl, let alone fly. But, you know, cartoon logic.
He should just crawl his way. He should drag his way all the way back to Agrabah.
No, not even makes it to Agrabah. He, like, dies, like, 15 feet from the lamp. And the rest of the movie is Iago's corpse slowly decomposing, being, were there vultures in Agrabah?
I don't think so, but I don't know.
If not vultures, then whatever desert insects and bacteria are around.
Wow, I love this, like, David Lynch directed Aladdin movie.
Honestly, it sounds more like a Lars von Trier to me.
I was gonna say Lars von Trier too. Yeah, wow.
Man, now I want to see a Lars von Trier Disney movie.
That would be interesting. But yeah.
By the way, here's a fun fact, speaking of like independent filmmakers doing Disney movies. You know that Disney offered Bill Plimpton six figures to animate the genie in the original movie?
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Bill Plimpton turned it down because if he had taken that contract, then Disney would have had intellectual property rights for any ideas that Bill Plimpton came up with while he was working at Disney. But that would have been something to see, huh? That would have been wild.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So Iago gets... So Iago leaves and heads to Agrabah and immediately starts scheming to get back in the palace's good graces by endearing himself to Aladdin, you know, lying and saying that he was mind controlled by Jafar, which, give Aladdin credit, he does not buy.
No. Which is very fair.
Yeah. But then he ends up being cornered by Abyss Maul and his goons, and Iago ends up saving his life. And so Iago's life...
He owes him one.
Aladdin's like, yeah, maybe I owe this guy one, which... You know, I guess you consider that even for Iago being the villain the first time around. Yeah. But
no.
But I guess Aladdin's playing it, like, generous. So he figures, all right, maybe I'll help it out. I'll talk to the Sultan and see that Iago's given a fair hearing.
Yeah.
So I guess they're going to drag the parrot before, like, a court of law.
I like to think that he's, like got a trial or whatever. And
the genie would do like an L.A. Law parody. It would probably be L.A. Law if it's 1994.
So Iago is like, OK, you're gonna, whatever. So Aladdin's like, OK, let me go talk to him. But Sultan and Jasmine are both like. You know, if I ever see that little bitch bird again, I'm going to kill him.
Yeah,
you know,
it's weird. Like, we also got to mention that in between that, then and there, the genie returns and he like has an entire song about how after traveling the world, he's come back to Agrabah because he wants to be with his friends, which is nice. But I don't know. Do you feel like it kind of cheapens the ending of Aladdin if he gets his freedom only to go like right back to Agrabah to be like,
no, I think it was fine that he came back because he was like, I saw it all and I missed you guys. Like, that's kind of funny. But then they sing the friendship song and it's like, oh, OK. It literally ends with them being like, I love being your friend or whatever the fuck.
Nothing in the whole wide world like quite like a friend.
And they're standing at the castle literally singing to no one, just like arms up, like, you know, like. Friendship, and it's like, oh, okay,
By the way, there was no consistent one songwriting team for this movie. There was like a whole bunch of different songwriting teams for like each song. So if the songs feel a bit disjointed, that's probably why.
You know, they each feel like their own individual things, and I don't think any of them feel like they really fit where they are. Maybe the Iago ones, but.
I like to imagine that they offered Alan Menken to write more songs for this. And wait, you want me to write songs for Gilbert Gottfried? And then Alan Menken just cracks up and slams the door in their face.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's no actual factual evidence for that happening. But
so then Aladdin's like, I'm going to go talk to him. They're like, fuck that bird in particular, because he comes up for some reason. And
like for some reason they're more hostile to the bird than Jafar.
Which to be fair, they kind of were like on equal levels in the first one, at least with how into the things they were into the evil plot, you know.
But I mean, Jafar's the one who like. Put the castle on top of the hill and became Sultan, became the sorcerer and a slave Jasmine, and then trapped her in like a giant hourglass and turned to a giant snake.
Yeah, I think the Sultan has personal beef with him because when he was like chained up or whatever at the end of Aladdin.
He was turned into like a jester on marionette strings.
Yeah, and he Iago kept shoving crackers in his mouth.
Yeah, which...
So maybe he has a personal vendetta against him.
I mean, the Sultan also shoved crackers in Iago's mouth.
I know.
Never even bothered to ask Jafar if Iago even liked crackers.
Yeah. So really, Sultan's the one in the wrong here. But I think he's just projecting. So
I like how we're also automatically on the movies we like Iago side.
Yeah. I don't know why either, but like, it's just something about.
I think it's that like, Gilbert Gottfried is so abrasive that he goes right back around to endearing and as like a performer. Yeah. And also like in this movie, there's like a genuine vulnerability to Iago.
Yeah.
By the way, before we get back to the plot, I want to mention this because I'll be remiss if I don't mention this. Is it just me or does everyone in this movie look a bit off model from the original?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Like Iago's forehead is too small. Aladdin's face looks off. The genie has like a weird curved jaw now.
Yeah, I think that also, and like it's not consistent throughout the movie. There's scenes where like their models are just different from they were in like the scene prior. And I think that's just because it was, kind of out, like the animation was like outsourced.
Well, it was done in like two different studios. It was done at, I believe, Walt Disney Studios Japan, Walt Disney Studios Australia. Wait, was any done at France?
I don't think so.
No.
I've only seen Australia and Japan, but like, yeah, it was getting passed around a bit, and it was. I don't think anyone went back in to fix certain things. So,
which granted, for a lot of the what would soon become a Disney Toon Studios production, that was a standard operating procedure.
Yeah,
but this is before like really Disney's Toon Studios was necessarily established. Right then, it was just Walt Disney Television Animation. They just spun off Disney Toon Studios from that.
Yeah, no, they do look a little bit off from even their just original models. Don't know what that's about, but So Aladdin tries to say to the Sultan.
He tries to put in a good word for Iago, but he just uses Iago's late mesmerized by Jafar excuse.
Yeah.
Which.
So.
Like, he doesn't even bother trying to say, oh, Iago saved my life. I feel like I owe him one. Maybe we should give him a chance.
Yeah. So basically some chaos happens where, like, the tiger chases Abu and Iago into the room that they are. And Sultan's just like, what is he doing here? And Aladdin's like, he's fine. And Jasmine's like, what the fuck? And then... kind of storms out and is just like, I'm angry with you because you were hiding something from me. And then, which is fair, I guess, but you can talk about it. But then instead of talking about it, they start singing about how much they love each other. Well, Iago starts a song about like,
Because like the genie convinced him to try to like help prepare the rift between, Aladdin and Jasmine. So, Iago has another song, a love song, where he's got to like trick Aladdin into remembering why she fell in love with Aladdin in the first place.
So it's kind of an anti-love song because he's like, love sucks. Don't you hate love?
My really is revolting. It's even worse than when you're molting.
Yeah. And Jasmine's just like, oh, yes. Love, I'm in love. Oh, and then she goes and dances around outside with Aladdin, who starts singing together. And it's like, okay, but like, are you going to talk about your problem? Because like, literally, they're just singing about like generically in love. And it's like, oh wow, this is really
generically. Isn't generically in love sort of Disney's brand of love?
I know, but it's like it feels especially like a punch in the face here because it's like. You could like even the you could be like talking about like, I'm sorry, I hid something from you, Jasmine. Like in the song and Jasmine's.
Aladdin tries to, but then is interrupted by the generic and love song.
It was just a timing thing.
And granted, they do like have like the formal discussion of it afterwards.
Yeah, but it was just like, OK, you don't really need this. Felt really out of nowhere. Kind of sucked. But I like the initial like idea of it, of Iago singing like a non-love song, and it working, being so generic, like that's kind of funny actually. But
I think if it wasn't for the fact that Gilbert Gottfried's the primary singer on it, Forget About Love would probably be the strongest song of the bunch.
I think so too. So as all this is happening, we've kind of skipped over like something, which is the fact that this movie is called Return of Jafar. And as like in between scenes of this, we are also given Jafar returning. Because it's just so like out of the way and it takes so long to happen. So basically, fucking Jason Alexander and his little group of thieves or whatever is in the desert, and they try to like kill him, but then he gets the lamp and he's like, oh, I have a genie now.
By the way, I watched Return of Jafar on Disney Plus, and it's got one of those like before the movie disclaimers about how it's like culturally insensitive, and I go to this website to learn more. And I think Abyss Maul's gang is one of the primary reasons why. Hell, even Abyss Maul, the name, while funny pun, is a bit iffy.
Yeah. So he's like got this lamp now, and Jafar is like, I'm free. Hell yeah. And Abyss Maul is like, no, you ain't. I've got you, you know?
Well, and yeah, because he's like bound by the rules of the genie.
Yeah. And I really wanted to like their dichotomy, but it's just something about it is lacking, you know?
Well, I think it's that there's barely any showcase of the dynamic at all.
And it could be so good because it's like this pathetic little man holding power over like this like genie or whatever, who's so powerful and like, you know, smart and scheming and stuff like that, but is like ultimately at the hands of this dude. That could have been so good, but then it takes them like forever to realize that they have a common enemy, which is Aladdin. And like, it's just annoying. And it's like, oh, cool, I think I know where you're going to go with this. Like kind of like a, you know, a buddy cop thing, but like the opposite, you know, like maybe they'll start like getting along or something like that, you know, working it out, which would have been very, very fun. But no, it's just kind of Jafar bossing him around.
Yeah. And it seems like a very poor way to introduce what would be like probably the main recurring villain of the TV series.
Yeah. He has no like presence here. I wish he had more presence.
Yeah.
So now they are back on their way to the castle to you know,
get fuck, because Jafar's got like his whole revenge plan, and Abyss Maul wastes like his first two wishes because Jafar isn't like the genie where, you know, the genie is of the genie variety where, you know, he'll try to make the wish work out the best way possible. For his guy, Jafar is the kind of genie who will make an ironic wish that'll backfire on you. So like,
and then make you have to wish your way out of it.
Yeah,
yeah. So now they're on their way, and then
which, how does that not violate the supposed rules of the genie? Like, if you think that the genie has such strict rules, you think that they would also safeguard against like orchestrating the wishes against the wisher's best interest. Yeah. I'm curious if there's like rules of like a genie trade union.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess now we're at the part where like Jafar makes it back and then is like, Iago's like, I'm just glad I don't have to stand in the shadow of Jafar ever again. And Jafar is just like, hey, bitch. And Iago's like, oh. and then Jafar has worked his way on the inside because now Iago is terrified of him again and under his like kind of control because he's been threatened and whatever. And then Iago's like basically Jafar tells Iago to get Aladdin to take the Sultan somewhere in particular, so they have a little plan in place, trap, and yeah, so that happens.
Yeah, really the rest, as you could say, this movie has like a two act structure where the first act is like Iago having to initially endear himself to Aladdin. And then the second half is like Jafar's plan coming into motion and and like Iago feeling morally conflicted. Like it seems like this was, and it probably was, this was initially written as like two episodes that were like done as a two-parter. Like it even feels like there are like commercial break fade outs in the second half. Yeah,
there are. We also get a Jafar song in the second half.
Oh yes, a Jafar song that isn't a reprise and probably the best song of the bunch. There's still some like weird lyrical choices in there. Like,
yes,
granny's gonna grab ya.
Yeah, I liked the word zabracadabra that he just like yells out of nowhere. And then he yells a bunch of other nonsense magic words. And it's really funny. But like, basically, the entire song is him like, hey, genie, I'm better than you.
It's a genie diss track.
And it's really funny because like it was set up in a way like the one thing about genie in this iteration is like it has nothing to do with the fact that it's not Robin Williams. It's the fact that he's just kind of like written as like this pathetic character, which really sucks that he's only comic relief and not like a powerful entity, which he is, you know. And it's
they had to diminish his power because the first movie had the limitations of three wishes. But given that he's supposed to be a recurring character in like both a sequel film and a TV series, they had to diminish his power a bit so that he's not an instant, you know, plot resolution for like every conflict.
But that's what makes it feel weird, because it's like we already know that he has a bunch of power, you know? So it's like, why is he here at all then, I guess?
To make pop culture jokes.
Yeah, but then
because
like
the kids like him.
Yeah, I know. Like, no, like I get it logistically why they chose to, you know, make him less powerful or whatever. But it's like he literally like gets slapped in the face by Jafar and just like falls over and like passes out. And it's like, OK, this is, you know, it's a big leap down. And it was very funny that you described it as the genie diss track, because that is what it is. But I would have also loved a rap battle between Genie and Jafar. Like, that's what.
Whoa now. Rap in the 90s? That's a bit too controversial for Disney.
Yeah. My brain was like, man, I wish this was a rap battle. That would have been so good, you know? But, you know, that's fine. Anyway. Yeah, so Jafar captures the Sultan, and then they beat Jafar.
Yeah.
Like, that's the movie.
Yeah, like Iago has a change of heart again, or like maybe he was already conflicted and like decides to wait until like when Jafar's not looking to save the genie so he can save Aladdin. And
he's the genie is stuck in this little crystal ball thing that every time they show it, he's the genie's just sitting in there like pouting. And I as we were watching it I referred to it as the poutin orb because like he literally was making the same face the entire time, which was just I'm sad. You know, like they screwed me over in this movie. I used to be so cool. And then they frame Aladdin for murder, but then obviously it's not actually him. And
by the way, it seems like Razul, the head guard, was itching at the bit to get an opportunity to kill Aladdin.
Oh yeah,
like he does not have like having Aladdin around.
No. He's just so full of rage.
Maybe Razul is the Ted Knight now. No, Jafar is the Ted Knight, and then Razul is the Robert Stack in this scenario.
Yeah.
Because Robert Stack was the villain in Caddyshack too, if you don't get the joke.
Yeah. So.
And that would mean that, Friend Like Me is I'm All Right, and then your only second rate is nobody's fool.
Yeah. I've actually like never seen Caddyshack in full, but
Man, we got to do that at some point.
Yeah, my as a child though, it was some kind of novelty toy that my grandparents had, but it was like it was a beaver, right? Or woodchuck?
It's a gopher. In Caddyshack, it's a gopher in the golf course, like a puppet gopher.
It's a gopher, and you would hit a button and it would sing "I'm All Right." And it never came out of its box. It was always in its box, and we would always just hit the try me button and it would go, "I'm all right." And it would dance around. It would do like the first, it would do the chorus of that song, and then it would stop, and then we'd do it again. And that's how I entertained myself as a 4-year-old. I would sit on my grandparents' floor and just,
do you still have that toy?
They might still have it. I'll see if my grandma still has it. And,
yeah, you'll have to bring that, there. It could be our house band. It could be our show's house band.
Yeah. Yeah. The Caddyshack Gopher from yeah. Damn, I wonder if they still have that. That would be very funny.
I actually got my grandfather a Hallmark Christmas ornament of the Caddyshack Gopher that you press the button and plays "I'm All Right."
Nice. Yeah, I feel like that was a big marketing thing for them.
Well, the Gopher was a Bill Murray's idea.
Nice.
Well, having the gopher be a puppet, the gopher idea was a plot element because the production of Caddyshack was a mess. Originally, it was supposed to be like a film about the caddies played by the young kids with Rodney Dangerfield and Bill Murray and Chevy Chase being like supporting characters. But then the film absolutely wasn't working. But the stuff with the veteran comedians is really funny. So they reshot and re-edited a lot of it so that... Yeah. It's primarily a comedy focused on them with the caddies now supporting characters. And then to give the film a through line, they added more scenes of Bill Murray trying to hunt down the gopher. I think Harold Ramis probably described it best as a modernization of the Marx Brothers comedies, where it's mainly the Marx Brothers antics, but also they're helping out some normal people. And then there's a villain.
Yeah.
Man, we're talking a lot about Caddyshack. More Caddyshack than I was expecting this time around.
Hey, you never expect the Caddyshack, I guess. But here it is.
It's like as the tagline of Caddyshack 2 said, "The Shack is back."
The Shack is back, and Jafar is back, and then he's back in his lamp.
Because no, he's not back in his lamp. He's dead.
Oh yeah, he's dead.
They it turns out in order to kill a genie, you've got to destroy its lamp. So
he created a bunch of lava, and then Iago tells Jafar to shut up, which is so good.
Because initially he was like, "Hey, I saved Aladdin's life. I don't owe you guys anything else. I'm staying out of danger." But then of course he has the Han Solo moment, sweeping back in at the last minute to save Aladdin and such, and Jafar zaps him, and it seems like Iago's dead. We're all sad, but Iago uses his last breath to knock the lamp into the lava, and Jafar dies, and they saved Iago's corpse, and everyone's sad. And Aladdin's like, "Wait, I thought genies couldn't kill." And then Iago's like, "Well, you could be surprised what you can live through," because that's recurring through lines throughout the film. Those lines, "Genie, you can't kill you. You'd be surprised what you can live through," which is legitimately is a genuinely great line and is utilized well.
Yeah, but yeah. So Iago is good, and I'm glad he got to tell Jafar to can it. And
yeah. Jafar is dead. Though Jafar does end up returning one more time in the Aladdin crossover episode.
With Hercules.
Yes. Yeah, Hercules, the animated series. The episode Hercules and the Arabian Night.
And he teams up with Jafar.
Yeah, Hades teams up with Jafar. And they try to... It's like a Strangers on a Train scenario where they try to take out the other's enemy.
Now I kind of just want to watch that. I kind of just want to watch the Hercules Aladdin crossover. But yeah, so that's... the movie.
Is Hercules the animated series on Disney Plus? I know the Aladdin animated series apparently isn't.
Yes. Hercules is on Disney Plus. I watched part of it last night. So,
let me check. I'm pretty sure that the Aladdin animated series, for whatever reason, is not on there. Disney Plus, and I have no idea why. So, is that everything we have to say on Return of Jafar?
I think it might be. Like you said, we're going to talk about the rest of the Robin Williams stuff in another episode. So,
yeah. So, what are our final thoughts on this movie? Like, we already talked about, like, its impact and its, like, financial success.
Yeah. It's got a very short running time. It's an hour and 10 minutes. It felt longer for some reason to me.
Well, all movies feel longer to me because I always, for whatever reason, always keep pausing and unpausing them.
I don't, but, like, you know, but, like, so it just felt long because I think it drags in a lot of places, like, a lot of places. I like it ultimately as an idea, and you know, there are good elements in it. I think it's a little bit, there's a lot of stuff that drags it down enough for me to think of it as like a very generic movie, which I wish I didn't, because I think that, you know, having the sidekick of the villain being like the main character.
It's novel.
Yeah, that's like a fun idea, and it could have been a lot more fun, but because it wasn't as fun as it should have been. I'm not like the biggest fan of it, but you know.
I'm of two mindsets with this movie. As a movie, it's mediocre, but as a television pilot, it's pretty solid.
Like that's very fair. Yeah.
Like I honestly think in the long run, both for this film as a whole and for Disney in general, it was a mistake to make this a direct-to-video film, because both like for its impact on the industry and also like the value on this. Like if we were looking at this as a television pilot, I'd say it's pretty strong.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very fair.
Like, yeah, you know, it sets up like the new status quo. Like, it reestablishes the characters and their dynamics. You know, it leaves you intrigued for what new adventures the cast is going to go on.
Yeah, it does do those things.
It introduces a recurring villain, not as well as I would have liked. I think the use of Abyss Maul in this is the film's one weak spot.
Yeah, no, it doesn't seem like he's going to be the recurring villain.
No, he feels more like a one-off.
Yeah.
Honestly, I feel like having Jafar return for your pilot only to kill him off was a mistake. They should have like either like saved him for like in the middle of the series, or like kept him around as a recurring villain and then kill him off at the end of the series.
Yeah. He could have been like built up to be a big bad, like you know, oh no, Jafar's gonna come back. He's got a plan, you know. He's had a year to sit around in that lamp. I'm sure he would have been doing a lot of thinking.
It's like if they introduced, to compare it to another Tadstone series, Negaduck in the pilot for Darkwing Duck, and then just kill him off that first episode, and he never shows up again.
Yeah, it wouldn't make much sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you could argue that they did that with Tars Bulba in the Darkwing Duck series, but A, I think Tars Bulba came back, and then B, Tars Bulba wasn't nearly as memorable a villain as like the rest of them, I'd say. Yeah, I guess that's our thoughts on Return of Jafar. Oh, here's something I forgot to mention. They actually adapted Return of Jafar for Kingdom Hearts 2.
Yes, that's
the story
of
Agrabah in Kingdom Hearts 2. They adapt Return of Jafar, complete with Iago redemption arc.
Redemption arc, yep. Which is a lot of fun. It was the first sequel of a Disney movie to be put into Kingdom Hearts.
You're right. That's right. Did they ever adapt any other direct-to-video sequels to Kingdom Hearts?
No,
I mean, they adapted the Mickey, Donald, Goofy, Three Musketeers, but that's not a sequel, per se.
Yeah, no, I don't know if they did any direct-to-video sequels. I think that it stands alone in that, as far as I know.
So, that's pretty much all we've got to say on Return of Jafar. So
yeah,
I think this is a pretty solid start for season two. I'm glad we're doing this together. You know, more seasons ahoy, more episodes ahoy. Next episode will be our 25th episode, and we've got something special planned for that.
We do.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
We're gonna sign off now. From all of us here in Lost in the Vault, thank you for being with
us. Next time on Lost in the Vault.
Coming to theaters November 27th.
Mister, you okay in there, right?
Beware the cyborg.
This appears to be some kind of map.
This is the moment Jim Hawkins had always dreamed of.
Whoa, treasure planet.
Now, he's determined to go for it.
This is my chance to set things right.
I don't want to lose you.
Make you proud.
Robert Louis Stevenson's greatest adventure, Treasure Island, as it has never been seen before.
All hands to station!
Walt Disney Pictures presents Treasure Planet.
How cool is this?
What are you looking at, weirdo?
Yeah, weirdo.
Brace yourself. What a pleasure to meet you, Jimmy.
It's Jim.
And you are? I want to say Larry.
He may be on a quest for gold.
Gonna make people see me a little different.
Mr. Silver?
Cyborg.
But he better watch out for Silver.
Change in plotline!
Pirates on my ship!
Oh, mama.
We move now!
This isn't over yet.
Sometimes...
Come on!
Courage can be the greatest treasure of all.
You think a pup like you can take on the likes of me?
Watch me.
Treasure Planet.
Captain Flint?
In the flesh! Except for skin, organs, or anything that resembles flesh.
Well, you made it this far, so I guess you like our show. Want to support it? Check us out at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Or simply go to our website at anchor.fm/lostinthevault. You can also follow us on Twitter at LostVaultCast and Instagram at LostVaultPodcast. You can also email us at lostinthevaultpodcast@gmail.com or join the official Discord, link in the episode description. And also please remember to rate, review, and share. We really appreciate your feedback. Thanks for listening.